trek through this forest and on its tracks, etc., and as you say, being very much aware of the fact there might be a mine underneath you, that must have been exceedingly wearing.
You were just living on your nerves all the time. An anti-personnel mine wouldn't that was an infantry mine, but there was all kinds of booby traps. There were masters at it, the Germans, masters at it. And as I say, when we came out of the Reichswald, it was the worst experience that I've ever had. It made Normandy like a scheme, like nothing. Of course, we're different people then as well. We're more wary and we're more. The fun had gone out of it, if you know what I mean. It was never fun, but the excitement of it had gone out of it. There was hatred for the Germans, for what they'd done, for all the boys that had been killed. And some of the infantry regiment had lost 120%. Since Normandy, there were new people that were there. Everyone was young. So I said that young boy was 17. Now, we'd never have had a 17-year-old on D-Day. You weren't allowed there unless you were 19. They were scraping the barrel at this particular time, and if you go to some of these cemeteries, you'll see boys of 18 and 17. And I believe there's a Durham boy at 16. I've never seen that grave, but to tell me. They were really scraping the barrel. They must have given wrong ages, of course. But was bitter fighting.
You were sort of the bitter and the fanaticism of it all. Were you in a situation basically where you were even running over Germany?
Yes, all the time. All the time. Well, all the time. You just couldn't get away from bodies. Down in the Ardennes, the bodies were frozen solid. They were like. They were just like pieces of. Solid frozen, well, like taking a piece of meat out of a freezer. That's what they were like. But here in the wet, because it didn't stink like it did in Normandy. That was one of the worst parts of Normandy, the stink. But because you didn't get that up in the Ardennes. But some of the sights were dreadful. I think we'd got hardened to it. It wasn't the sights that we'd got hardened to that long ago. It was the fear of the mines. And the bitterness, and the cold, and as you say, the lack of sleep as well, the whole lot. And we didn't expect to live. We'd seen so many go, and so many new ones come. It was going to be our turn soon. And it was the
inevitable.
I could never say that word of it all. It was just a matter of time before you got yours.
You mentioned, I think, that there were German parachutists.
Yes.
Parachute troops.
There were some very, very, very good troops there, German paratroops, holding these chateaus and things. Some elite troops.
Did you have any narrow squeaks yourself that you recall?
Well, there was one particular case, around about this particular time, when I was talking to someone, I think it was after we'd left the Reichswald, I was talking to someone and a tank shell went between me and him and went right through an empty vehicle behind us. That was the nearest squeak I ever had. And I said, well, that was close. If we get away with that, we'll get away with anything, or something like that, you know. But the shelling at night... Now, I remember jumping out of the tank and the shells were coming right in a direct line to us. They were zooming in on us, and I jumped out slowly because the crew were getting out. The officer was getting out slow. You couldn't dash. You had to take things easy. You hadn't to show any panic. And I jumped in the trench and within a minute a shell had come over and gone about a yard on from me. If he'd come a yard short, he'd have been right in the trench beside me. That was another very narrow thing. And the noise of that, I think, affected my ears, because now I'm having a lot of this noise in my ears, you know, sometimes worse than others.
What's it like to be under shellfire? What are your personal feelings?
It doesn't matter who you are. I don't. You can be the bravest of the brave, but eventually, it'll the constant hammering of shells coming down and waiting for the next one. It just wears you out.
Is there a feeling of wanting to get into the ground like
yes.
animal?
You can't get any further down. You're hearing about people saying that they've dirtied the pants. Well, I never did that. I don't know anyone that did. But it would be easy enough to do. It was a terrible thing. And when the shelling stops, but we'd had so much of it. It's something you never get used to. It's death all round. And of course, there's people getting killed as well. That's what makes it worse. And the noise, I think, is the main thing.
Are there any other memories of the Reichswald?
Not really. The infantry dropping all round. And I thought, how brave some of these infantry lads were. How boys can give their lives like that. It's tremendous admiration for the infantry. That's what we had. Tremendous admiration. It was unbelievable what those infantry lads went through.
And you, even as a driver, would see them falling.
Yes. Yes. Dreadful. They were all rounders in the trees and snipers and things like that. Dreadful. It was a killing ground at Reichswald, an absolute killing ground. It put everything else we've been through into the shade.
Prisoners, did you take any? Did you see any?
Oh, yes. Yes, got quite a few prisoners. They were just sent back. The infantry lads took them back.
What was their attitude once you got them?
I think they were glad from what I could see. I think they were pretty glad to get out of it. I know I would have been. but it wasn't so much in the Reichswald, it was after when the prisoners started coming in. Those 15 out in the chateau, those 15, very, very brave lads, you know. You could have nothing but respect for them, for holding up. But I think they were glad to get back. But these after that went in the buildings and things, and in the villages.
Do you remember the names of the places you were coming into now?
We're heading for Cleves and Gok. That's where we're fighting for. Out of the Reichswald, straight into Cleves and Gok. Because we're heading eventually for Wesel to cross the Rhine. We didn't know that at the time, but we crossed the Rhine at Wesel with the 15 Scottish. I wasn't there then.
So, in effect, you got through the Reichswald after this bitter fighting, and you're getting now into German towns and villages.
Yes, and they'd been bombed. They were bombed by the Air Force. Total unrecognisable towns. They were bombed. They were just a pile of rubble. There was no need for that. The surprising thing was, and looking back and thinking about it, I don't remember seeing any civilians. I can't remember any civilians much. They must have been there, but I just can't remember seeing them. The one thing about the towns and these small towns, I should imagine Cleve would be not much bigger than Barnard Castle. Would be at least you could get in, and the infantry could get in out of the wet weather. You could get into the buildings for shelter. So that was one consolation. And that went on through February, fighting through here.
Was it again a fighting retreat by the Germans?
Yes, all the way. All the way, street by street. All the way through the rubble. That was a different kind of fight than the Reichswald. This was right through the rubble. And at that particular time, they flooded the area to our left, where the Canadians were, the Falkland Islands and all. They flooded it. They opened some, I think they opened the riverbank of the Rhine or whatever it was, and flooded a massive area. I think the Canadians had a hell of a job getting out of there. There was something I remember about water, and but I can't remember what it was. But I know that we were short of food at the time, and I went. There was on the bank side. There was a 1500 weight standing, and we went and got a box of rations out of it, and we brought it back to the tank. And within a minute of us bringing it, it got a direct hit with the shell and blew it up. We just got our rations off in time and threw it on the back of the tank. And that was where the floods were. That was all where the flooding was. The tanks couldn't move. They had to keep on the road. The whole area was bog, was bog, boggy ground. You couldn't move. And then we went into Cleves, fighting all the way, these villages. Something like Breville. It wasn't Breville, but it was a name, something starting with a B. Terrible bombing. And spent some time in there. And then eventually we got to Gok. The Gok was a mass of troops. And they were going to bring the regimental band out. We were going to have a rest in Gok. Front line, it was front line, but they were going to bring the regimental band in March. Well, on the 4th of March, I'm on the outskirts of Gok in a building when the shelling was terrible. There was shelling from a long way off, and that added to all the rubble in the place. There was shelling all and sundry, and big guns. They had big guns, and down in the cellar there was all kinds of preserves in jars, all kinds of preserves. And it would have been nice to sample them, but we were warned not to touch anything like that. You had to be very careful. You're walking about as if everything was made of, you know, you didn't touch anything in case it was booby-trapped. You went through it very, very carefully looking for booby-traps before you could be sure that the room that you were in was clear. You didn't go to the toilet. You didn't pull the chain of a toilet. That was a common joke, that. Never pull a chain when you were in. Because you've got more than you bargained for. There was a booby trap in there. So all these preserves, which we never touched, I believe a lot of them did, but we were told not to touch the preserves because it might be poisoned. There was all kinds of destruction went on with the infantry. I'd thrown plates and I'd thrown the bedroom windows and of these things. It was, I don't know, it was probably getting rid of some of the aggro that was in them, you know, what they'd been through. But anyway, we were in this down in the cellar where these preserves were, and quite cozy when we got shelled this particular night. And from one minute it was quite calm, and the next minute it was just a mass of flames. And I was on my own at the time, don't know where the others were. And it was in the afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and suddenly the whole place was smoke, fumes, and flames, and I couldn't get out. I had a hell of a job getting out in the smoke and things. And when I did get out into the street, my shirt was on fire down the front, and I felt my hot face and hands, and I realised that I'd been burned. I was picked up by a 1500 weight truck to whip me off to a first aid place. First aid, that's what we thought. And when we came across a first aid place, that was between Gok and Cleves on the side of the road. And it was manned by either the Sherwood Rangers or the Sherwood Foresters. I don't know. Probably the Sherwood Foresters. And they were playing cards when I went in, and they didn't bother to stop playing cards. They just put a bandage on and covered my head, covered my face with, and my hands with the bandages, and put a ticket on my shirt front and said, right, carry, take him down. This lad said, well, I can't, I don't, I'm only giving him a lift. You take him down, further down, you'll find a CRS, Catholic Receiving Station. So he took me, this young lad, this lad under 1500 weight, to this third CRS. I remember seeing this thing outside, third CRS. These are things that stand out in your mind. I don't know how it does, but it does. And then they looked at the little ticket, little, like a railway ticket you got in a case, a travelling ticket, and it said what these lads had done, and they said, take him into Nijmegen, there's a hospital there, a field hospital. So he hummed and hard, but he took me to the field hospital and left me there. This was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And they gave me some pineapple chunks, some white bread, some English nurses, and looked at my ticket and said, right, oh, here you are, have this pineapple chunks. And then after about half an hour, they put me onto an ambulance to take me with some more further back. And I went to work for the night. We stayed at Hertogenbosch, which was in the Canadian sector. And we went into this large village hall with beds down either side and little cubicles at the bottom. And there was two German boys in front of me, two young boys, badly worse than I was. But she made them wait till after she'd... They made them wait till all the British people and Canadian people had been done, and then they attended to the Germans. So just looked at the ticket and said, get into bed. No pyjamas or anything, no, just in your muck. You just got in as you were, like, and couldn't do anything. I had both my hands bandaged. Didn't do anything. And then they gave us 20 gold flake and left the two German boys out. And then in the morning they gave us another 20 gold flake and left the two German boys out, which we gave them some fags. We couldn't see them without the smoke. I think one had lost his hand and the other one was bandaged round the chest, just his overcoat round him. So can't have been more than 17. And then they took us out and put us onto a train. I don't know what happened to the German boys. I never saw them go on the train. But we were put onto a train and taken right down to Bruges, to the 110 British General at Bruges. And that was 9 o'clock at night when we got there. And every 2 hours we got an injection off a big fat nurse. She gave us a penicillin injection every 2 hours. Everybody on the train, because we could see you coming, and there was a big shout and scream. Was very happy, really.
Were you in pain?
Quite a bit, yes.
They put cream, or was it just the bandages themselves?
They'd put something on, I think. I don't know what it put on. But when we got down to the hospital, they told us put me in a little room with some more burn cases. I think it was called a resuscitation ward or something on the door. And then this young girl from Consett, called Margaret, took me along the passage, took all my clothes off, and the lad opposite was Grenadier Guards, and he had his hands tied up to the lamps. There was two of them, both out the Grenadier Guards, and the lad with his hands tied said, keep hold of your berry, Geordie. He said, oh, right, so I put my berry in my locker, and I'm just sitting on an old blanket at the foot of my bed, because the bed was all nice and pale blue. She put the old blanket on the bottom, and I sat there in my muck. Then she took me along and took all my clothes off, gave me a wash where she could, pyjamas, dressing gown, slippers, and into bed. And then eventually they took the bandages off, not that night, but the doctor came and cut all the blisters. Well, when it blistered, they cut them off and squirted like a yellow penicillin powder in. And altogether I was in there for a month, 4 weeks, before the burns. Now when it's very cold, it goes very, very dark red, my hands and face. Then we did, that was 4 weeks. Then we had to go downstairs. they'll take now a pistol off us. All our arms, everybody got their arms taken off them. So I got my pistol back, my belt, and a great big green hat. I said, I don't want one of them, I have my own. and he's had me cut by June. 1318 Hussars. So we went from there to a place like a convalescent place.
Before we come to that, just to stick with the hospital a little bit longer.
Yes.
Was it a highly disciplined hospital?
It was, yes.
Regimented and so on?
Oh, very, very much so. I was moved out of that little ward into a general ward, and there was beds down either side, then there was beds head to head down the middle of the ward. There was like four rows of beds. And I remember an RAF lad was brought in after an operation, and they tried to lift him off his bed, and he just sat up and he said, "Am I annoying you, sister?" And he said, "Not at all." And then he came out, thank God for that, but he added a few choice words in, and he didn't know he'd said it, because he was still under the thing. But they were saying that when the doctors came, you had to sort of lie to attention when they came in, and when you were starting to get better. But my recollection is that it was happy. And when we could get a bath, the little bathroom had two baths with us, and between the baths there was a space between the bath wall and the ceiling, and then there was wash basins right round. And I remember the Belgian girls used to use the bath. And I remember getting buckets of cold water and throwing them over the thing and hear them squeal as the cold water went into them. But I remember it being quite happy. And they were very, very good to us. There's no we had hospital blues and we were allowed to walk out. I found that everybody seemed to get the same size of blues. If you were a big bloke, you weren't so bad, it fit. But the shirts were enormous. Even the ties were big, red ties, a big white, the great big white, right down, you had to roll them over, and the blue jackets and blue trousers, royal blue jackets and trousers. They were hospital blues, for anyone that doesn't know. But they were all one size, big. And you went out into the town, and again, when I was saying about the Belgians profiteering, we didn't have any money, very little, but I think an ice cream was about 10 bob for an ice cream, you know. And the Belgians seemed to have plenty. The Dutch people had nothing. They were really starving, the Dutch. They had nothing, which is surprising, because they're so much like the Germans in so many ways. Even the languages are like, but they were very, very poorly off. But the Belgians seemed to have everything that was going. And then after we'd been in hospital...
Was it a British military hospital?
Yes, the British 110 British general.
And that British doctors? Nurses.
And nurses, yes. British general, the 110 British general. I always remember that. I don't know why that stuck in my mind. 110, I think they were marvellous.
We woke up at the same time every morning,
in
early hours?
Oh, yes, yes, you got to woke up every hour, in the early hours. Everything had to be cleaned and that.
Did you get visitors at all? Did anyone come to see you?
No, the padre did. See, I couldn't write letters at that particular time because both my hands were bandaged. So I was writing to... I was writing to two girls at the same time. And I wrote... The padre wrote down that I was in hospital, wounded or burnt. And I couldn't write because my hands were bandaged. And one of them sent me some fruit. So I knew I was going home on leave and I was going to have to pack one of them up. I couldn't go and visit them both. I couldn't spend my leave with both of them. So the one that sent me the fruit, I wrote and packed the other one up. And then the following day, I think fruit arrived from that one, or sweet or something. So I wrote and packed her up as well. So when I got to London, this is jumping the gun a bit, but when I arrived in London... From the hospital ship that took us home, I rang the girl from Petworth in Sussex, where we'd been stationed, and I had to ring the fire brigade to get a message to her. Couldn't ring her at home, and when I picked the phone up, you couldn't dial then, you had to get the operator, and she said, "That'll be half a crown or whatever it was." Oh, I said, "I'm sorry, I've only got..." She said, "You've only got what?" I said, "I'll have to ring you back. What have you got? I said, "I've only got French francs, or Belgian francs." She said, "Oh, that's all right." She says, I'll see to this. So I didn't have to put any money in, and she put me through to the fire brigade in Petworth, and they got a message to her that I was home in England and I would come next day and see her, which I did. But after we left, the padre was very good, and
this was your own regimental padre?
No, this was a hospital padre. No, the funny part of it, I just seemed to, looking back on that, I just, all I could do when I got burned was to try and get to a casualty receiving station, some first aid. That was all, to get something done. And this lad took me down to the first aid. I didn't see anybody, I didn't see my officer or crew or anybody, I didn't tell anybody where I was going or what had happened. And yet they seemed to know. Somebody knew about it, because nobody said had posted me missing, believed killed or whatever. That was what I was worried about, whether my mother had got a letter to say that I was missing, believed killed. But she never did. So this is another mystery to me, that somebody in the regiment must have known what had happened. I wasn't posted as a deserter either. I could have been. So somebody knew, somebody saw what had happened. Thank God. And then we went to...
You went to this convalescent place, you said?
To this convalescent, which was at Knock. And there were all these old little hotels that had been... that the people used after the war, or before the war. And we just worked in the mornings, like carrying whatever was wrong with you. It was to strengthen your arms. If you had bad arms, you had to carry these three trunks or pieces of wood and put them down, and then pick some more up, carry them back, and then you were doing relays like that. If you had bad legs, you were doing something different. It was what to strengthen up the part that had been damaged. And we had a fortnight of that, and then in the afternoon we were free to go around the town and spend our time in the sun. It would be April. It would be the beginning of April, second week of April. So 4th of March when I was hit. So this would be about the second week in April or so. And then from there, after 2 weeks of convalescent, we were given 7 days leave in England, English leave. It was called casualty leave. If you'd been in hospital more than 21 days, you got 7 days at home. So we were put went to Calais, and we were put on a hospital ship to go to New Haven. So went from Calais straight over to Dover. Instead of landing, we went along by the Seven Sisters. I remember the Seven Sisters. Pulled into New Haven. And then we were put onto a hospital train. And these had...
Were you received off the boat? Was the people waiting?
Doctors. There was doctors on the train. Doctors on the ship. And there was PRI people on the train, helping us right till we got to London, to the train. And when we got off the train at London, there was people standing at the barrier with telegraph pads. Can we send you a telegram? And cigarettes and pots of tea. Very kind people waiting at the barrier to do anything they could for us, which was marvellous. The war was still going on then.
Were you still in these hospital blues?
Oh no, we had, by that time we'd got our khaki, but no badges or anything.